Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right. From newatlas.com, in the world of infectious diseases, we are turning to the world's first koala chlamydia vaccine.
Ah.
How lucky for them.
Yes, very lucky for them because they have really been, they've been going through it, y'all.
Yeah, I had no idea. I actually saw this article and I mentioned this to a student of mine and she was like, thank God. And I thought she was kidding, but she actually had just watched a documentary about how they had chlamydia.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, wait, you knew?
Oh, poor things. But this is a rare bit of good news. This vaccine is the world's first for koalas, and it's been more than a decade in the making. Now, this will protect koalas from the widespread disease that causes painful urinary tract infections, infertility, blindness, and death. Until now, the only intervention when it comes to chlamydia relief for koalas has been antibiotics, which in turn upset their delicate digestive tract, which is kind of a big deal because they're evolved and fine-tuned to eat just eucalyptus leaves, which are not very nutritious. So they already have such a really delicate balance, and adding antibiotics just disrupts the whole system. And the worst part is that antibiotics don't protect koalas from repeat infections. And with infection rates as high as this, so over the span of a decade, they tracked 680 koalas, and they used 5 vaccine trials to give 165 animals the shot. The study found that it reduced the likelihood of koalas developing symptoms of chlamydia during breeding age. It decreased mortality from the disease in wild populations by at least 65%.
I mean, I guess koalas are pretty easy to catch. Like, again, they're not fast animals. You can just pluck them off a tree and shoot them up and then send them back out on their way.
Well, the vaccine's approval is just the first step because we're going to need more funding to roll out the programs to populations across the country. Because as you're hitting on here, administering jabs to wildlife is not the same thing as just taking your pet to the vet, which if you've taken a pet to the vet,
right, that's
you
hard
know
enough.
It's not easy anyway. Exactly. Now, koalas, they sleep up to 20 hours a day.
Oh.
And they do this high in tree canopies where they are very well camouflaged.
So you need some kind of blow dart to get
there you go.
Oh, no. Well, here's the thing. They're most active at night. They're solitary when they're not mating, and they're spread across vast distances. So getting the medicine to the animals presents some logistical challenges.
Yeah. I mean, it's a job that AI can't take. You got to admit that. Like, koala catcher is definitely going to stay human for a while.
Maybe. I've seen some robots.
Right, right. The tree climbing dog robots. Absolutely.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from today.com. It's titled, Man Has Tooth Implanted in Eye to Restore His Vision.
What?
Yeah, this is a wild medical thing. So Brent Chapman can see again after doctors pulled out one of his teeth, flattened it, drilled a hole in it, placed a lens inside, and implanted the tooth in one of his eyes.
Okay.
It seems bizarre, yes, but the complex operation, informally known as tooth and eye surgery, can can help restore vision in patients with the most severe forms of corneal blindness. Chapman, 34, who lives in North Vancouver, British Columbia, explained his first impression of the concept. I was like, who thought of this? Like, this is so crazy. So Dr. Greg Maloney, his eye surgeon and an ophthalmologist at Providence Healthcare's Mount St. Joseph Hospital in Vancouver, says, usually the reaction is shock and surprise and frank disbelief that it even exists. The technique was developed in the 1960s, and Maloney estimates several hundred people around the world have undergone the procedure. It's for patients who have a healthy back of the eye, but have suffered severe damage to the front of the eye, the cornea, from a chemical burn, a fire, or an autoimmune reaction where the immune system attacks the eye. Doctors need a way to restore a clear window to the back of the eye, like changing a severely damaged windshield in a car. It turns out that a tooth with a lens implanted in the eye is the solution.
Wow.
So Chapman was 13 years old when he lost his vision. He was playing in a high school basketball tournament, felt a little ill, and took a couple of ibuprofen pain relievers. Chapman had a life-threatening skin reaction to the medication known as Stevens-Johnson syndrome. He was in a coma for 27 days.
Oh, wow.
And he recovered, but his eyes were forever impacted. His left eye is irreversibly blind, while his right eye suffered severe damage to the cornea. He spent the next 20 years traveling the world trying different procedures to preserve any vision he had left, including 10 cornea transplants.
Oof.
Ouch.
Yeah, but they only worked for a short period of time, unfortunately. The damage to the surface of his eye was so severe that trying a cornea transplant was like trying to plant a flower in a desert. It's just not going to grow.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So humans have been trying for hundreds of years to figure out how to put an artificial cornea on the front of an eyeball. The biggest issue is getting it to stay in place so that the body doesn't reject it. A patient's own tooth can solve that problem.
I guess I'm just confused because a tooth is not transparent. So they're talking about adding a lens to it, but where's the tooth gone?
Oh, is the tooth just like the scaffolding around the lens?
Yes. So
it's like one of those pinhole camera kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a rim of
tooth. It almost looks like that. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Exactly. And so Maloney explains that it's bridging tissue between the body and the plastic lens that focuses the light. And there is a photo of a patient's eye after the procedure.
Do not recommend. I did it, and I do not recommend you Google it.
Yeah. I will. I'll describe it. So imagine somebody's eye, but the white is completely red, like flushed pink, and then the pupil is entirely like jet black.
Whoa.
That's what it looks like immediately after the procedure. And I assume, you know, it looks very different once it's healed. I did not look up post-op photos, but this one is right there in the article if you want to learn more.
Like a zombie eye.
Yeah. So the first stage of the two-step operation took place in February when Chapman had one of his teeth pulled. It had to be a healthy tooth that's quite robust in order to hold the lens, according to Dr. Ben Kang, who is his oral surgeon. He extracted one of Chapman's upper canine teeth, then shaped and flattened it down with a drill so that it became more rectangular.
Oh.
A hole is drilled in the middle of the structure, which allows the lens to be installed inside, and then the tooth was put back into Chapman's cheek and implanted in a fat pocket under his eye for 3 months so that the body could grow tissue around it.
Okay. Wow.
Hey, man, I got to read this next story with my eyes. And right. My eyes right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just crazy. And after waking up, Chapman could see hand motions right away, but it took a couple of months for his eye to heal and for his vision to sharpen. Chapman now has about 20/40 or 20/30 vision in that eye.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah. Studies on people who've undergone tooth and eye surgery show the chance that the lens is functional and in place in 30 years is better than 90%.
Holy cow.
And Chapman's chance of retaining his current level of vision in 30 years is about 50%. So not quite as good, but still, you know, really good odds, especially for somebody who has not been able to see most
or
of their
life. Or had to go through cornea transplants over and over and over.
Well, and at the same time, I guarantee you that did help in the process. Because, like, I had a friend in college who he lost sight in his eye when he was young. And some 15, 20 years later, it was a retinal thing. They managed to come up with a surgery that could reconnect it. And they did reconnect it. And they said, biologically, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to see. But his brain by that point had been like, well, we don't get any information from this, so we're not trying. And he never did regain sight because they were like, it's a neurological thing. Your brain is not interested in this signal. We promise you the signal is getting to your brain now where it wasn't before. So if he hadn't had all those surgeries to kind of keep maintaining some amount of sight over his life, maybe this wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
Right. That area would have gotten transferred to like sound and stuff.
Right. Or something. Yeah. The brain rewires itself.
Reassigned or atrophied. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Chapman is one of the first people in Canada to get the surgery. In the U.S., the first patient to undergo the procedure was a Mississippi woman in 2009. Currently, the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami says it's the only center in the U.S. that performs the surgery. Chapman says, it's a big, big surgery and a big step, but it was right for me.
Well, that's awesome.
He was like his own petri dish and incubator.
Yeah. And then once they get that, you know, tooth growing juice or whatever it is they're making.
That's true. We've had articles about how he can regrow his tooth in his mouth. He could become an endless supplier of teeth for... No, wait. They only work if you have your own teeth. Never mind.
Yeah, yeah. But we all can be. We're all just going to be teeth farms. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, we got some hard science here from SciTech Daily. Why is ice slippery? New study overturns 200-year-old physics theory. So for more than a century, we've been told around the world that pressure and friction make ice melt. The familiar winter slip on a frozen sidewalk is often blamed on body weight pressing through the soles of your still warm shoe. Now research from Saarland University indicates this view is incomplete. It turns out that neither pressure nor friction plays a particular significant part in forming the thin liquid layer on ice. Instead, computer simulations by the team reveal that molecular dipoles are the key drivers behind the formation of this slippery layer. But what is a dipole? A molecular dipole arises when a molecule has regions of partial positive and partial negative charges, giving the molecule an overall polarity that points it in a specific direction.
Mm-hmm.
Below 0 degrees Celsius, water molecules arrange themselves into highly ordered crystal lattices in which the molecules are aligned neatly, creating a solid crystalline structure. When someone steps onto this ordinary structure, it's not the resulting pressure of the shoe that disrupts the top layer of molecules, but the orientation of the dipoles on the shoe sole interacting with those on the ice.
Huh.
The previously well-ordered structure suddenly becomes disordered.
So basically, no matter how cold it is, if you put any kind of a polarized surface on ice, you're going to get a little melting.
Correct, because until now, it was assumed that skiing below negative 40 C is impossible because it's simply too cold for a thin lubricating layer of liquid to form.
Huh.
But it turns out, dipole interactions persist at extremely low temperatures. Remarkably, a liquid film still forms at the interface between ice and ski, even at near absolute zero.
Oh.
I mean, didn't like Finnish people know this forever, though?
Right. They're like, we slip. You can't deny that.
The film is, when it gets to that low temperature, it's viscous like honey.
Hmm.
But you can still ski on it and the film still exists. So obviously, for someone who's nursing an injury because they slipped and fell, like, this doesn't help. I think, though, it will give us in the future a way to maybe make dipole interactive shoes or plastics that adhere and fix to it instead of slipping.
Right. If you could somehow make sure that your polarity was going the correct way, the ice would already be lined up with it, and then it would stay frozen no matter what you did.
Mm-hmm. Probably not in our lifetime, and who knows what else dipole reactive shoes cause, but
right.
That's the future we're looking for. Next link.
Next link.
All right, well, this next one is super fun. It's from futurism.com, and it's called Nudists Declare War on SpaceX. So fans of NASA will, of course, be familiar with the Kennedy Space Center on Florida's coastline, where spacecraft are occasionally launched when NASA can get the funding. SpaceX, meanwhile, currently launches from a remote area in Texas, but they would really like to expand into Florida, and the FAA is considering their proposal. Specifically, SpaceX wants to make the Kennedy Space Center their launch point for their Super Heavy Starship, which is their next-generation launch vehicle in which both the boosters and the ship itself are reusable. In the short term, it's meant to add to sister company Starlink's considerable swarm of satellites, but in the long term, the idea is that this will be the ship that ferries people to Mars. Maybe. That's my editorial. Whatever. In the medium term, however, NASA has already contracted Starship as the human landing system for the planned Artemis 3 mission, which will hopefully put human feet back on the moon in 2027. So far, the ship has only done test launches from Texas, but the expectation is that it will shift over to Florida for the official Artemis launch. So the question really is this a one-time thing, or does the Starship program get to permanently set up shop in Florida? Now, the truth is SpaceX is already in Florida to a certain degree. They currently run a schedule of about 100 launches a year of their smaller Falcon 9 rockets, but adding the Super Heavy Starship to that rotation would increase the frequency of the launches by about another 60 per year, and more critically, it would expand the zone around the site that has to be shut down every time there's a launch of this much larger vehicle. So the FAA held a public hearing for anyone who wanted to express their concerns about this potential decision, and a variety of people showed up, and many of them were quite normal. The chief operating officer of Tampa International Airport, for example, noted that the Starship launches will cause widespread airline delays of up to 2 hours every time. Noise modeling scientists, meanwhile, calculated that nighttime launches will wake up around 42% of residents in the area, specifically when the Super Heavy booster lands again a few minutes after takeoff, because that's apparently the noisiest part of the process. They also noted that this number is an average, and that for people living in mobile homes and campers, the estimate is closer to 82%. Of course, besides the humans, there is the environmental impact on an area which is considered the most biologically diverse estuary in North America. Interestingly, however, most of the conservationists who spoke at the meeting took a more practical stance, pointing out that the pristine natural environment is a big draw for tourism, and that money would certainly go away if they scare off all the wildlife.
Yeah, because they don't care about the wildlife. They care about the money.
Right. Well, the environmentalists definitely care, but
yes,
they know their audience.
They know their audience. Yeah, exactly.
But the most controversial aspect of the plan is that several popular public beaches will now have to be closed on launch days, which residents say will definitely end up being more than 60 times a year because, quote, we all know every rocket launch gets slipped 20 times. One of those beaches is Playa Linda Beach, which is just one of four public beaches in Florida where nudity is legal. Thus, quite a few members of the American Association for Nude Recreation appeared at the FAA meeting, though they were disappointingly clothed. It should also be noted they were all over Zoom, as all members of the public were for this meeting. So if they had been naked, maybe they were naked from the waist down. You couldn't tell. And while they, of course, said there would be great harm done to their community if this public beach were shut down half the year, they also had some arguments that were not entirely self-serving. Deborah Sue Stevens, a former regional director of the nude organization, pointed out that there are nudists nationwide who travel to Florida specifically for these beaches. So, as with the animals, that tourism money would be lost. Current executive director Eric Schutthoff, meanwhile, argued that if all the nudists who currently go to Playa Linda are redirected to other nude beaches in the area, the numbers could become overwhelming and people might very well cross over the clothing optional boundaries and end up interacting with the locals. And that's not exactly an idle threat because, you know, while I think it's fair to say that even one non-consensual nudist sighting is too many, Stevens actually estimates that around 250,000 nudists travel to Florida each year.
Yeah, I can understand the non-consensual viewing of that. I have had one and it's not the people you want nude.
Right. Unfortunately, not everyone is sympathetic to the nudist's plight. Max West, for example, who is described by Futurism as, quote, a random man. Which I kind of feel like everybody's random. I mean, anyway, he said at the meeting that he plans to take photographs of the Starship launches and that, quote, the turtles and the nudists will just have to migrate.
Wow.
And he unfortunately may be right, because while this meeting did technically happen and the FAA has not officially made their decision yet, the fact is that a Starship tower has already been under construction at Cape Canaveral for more than a year, so everyone pretty much assumes it's a done deal. Like, they would be building it for the Artemis 3 launch either way, but they're not going to invest that much and then go, okay, never again.
I mean, Foxconn, I don't know.
Listen, if the nudist lobby is as powerful as it's sounding like they are.
Clearly, they're going to have to organize a huge moon in to really put the brakes on this.
Oh, no.
Or they could have a lot of sway.
Oh. Yeah. Next link.
Next link. Okay, we're going to stay in the world of romance, tangentially. Through AP News, we're talking about Ned. Ned is a perfectly nice snail, but a rare shell means he may have a doomed love life.
Aww.
Specifically, his shell coils to the left, which makes him the one in 40,000 snails whose sex organs don't line up with those of the rest of their species. So unless we can find another lefty snail, this young gastropod may face a lifetime of unintentional celibacy.
So they have to be like flat side to flat side, I guess, or something.
Kind of, yeah, or coil aligned, as it were.
Well, I don't know about snail anatomy, so I can't say, but it feels like all you had to do is turn around. Like, it's like a snail 69 situation, surely, but maybe not.
Yeah, there's definitely specific anatomical considerations. So the person who found Ned was one Giselle Clarkson. She was weeding her home vegetable patch when a snail came tumbling out. She happens to be an author and illustrator of a nature book called The Observologist, so true to her name. She has an affection for snails, and she had long been on the lookout for a left-coiled shell, which is also known in the snail world as a sinistral.
Mm.
So she sent a photo of the snail, pictured alongside a right-coiled gastropod as proof, to her colleagues at New Zealand Geographic. And in response, well, the magazine launched a nationwide campaign to find a mate for Ned. And yes, if you're wondering, he was named for the Simpsons character who once opened a store called The Leftorium.
Oh my God, that's Ned Flanders.
Okay. Yep. So that explains the male pronouns some use for Ned, although snails are technically hermaphrodites. They have sex organs on their necks, hello, and the capacity for both eggs and sperm. So here's sort of the gentle version to explain this, according to Clarkson. When you have a right coiling snail and a left coiling snail, they cannot slide up and get their pieces meeting in the right position. So only a lefty can mate with another lefty. And it's been a little bit lonely because there are a lot of people sending in photos of, quote, optimistically misidentified right coiling snails. People are really trying to help a net out here, but as of yet, no lefties have been forthcoming. Another issue is that New Zealand has really strict biosecurity controls, which means long-distance love if we do find a lefty in France or Saskatchewan, probably not going to be able to actually get to New Zealand in time for any kind of mating.
Right, because what are you going to do? Put it in the mail? And then it got snail mail?
No! Well, there have been other left-coiled snails that have benefited from public campaigns to find mates, so they're still optimistic even though they haven't gotten any results yet. For example, in 2017, Great Britain saw a sinistral snail they named Jeremy for the, at the time, left-wing politician and gardening lover Jeremy Corbyn. And he even got a New York Times obituary after his quest to find left-coil mates prompted the discovery of two prospective matches who initially preferred each other, not Jeremy. But Jeremy
got so cruel. There's only three of you in the world, and the other two are like, no, we're good, buddy.
I know. But eventually, Jeremy got the hang of it, and by the time of his death, he was able to produce 56 offspring who were all right-coiled snails. Poor thing. But it provided a wonderful chance for scientists to investigate what produces a left-coiled snail. And indeed, studies of snail farms in Europe prompted researchers to estimate that about one in every 40,000 snails is a lefty. But however he may feel about his prospects, Ned has some time. Garden snails live for 2 to 5 years, and his shell suggests he's still only about 6 months old.
I mean, listen, with the internet, we got Snail Grinder going on. I think they'll find somebody. Like you said, it's just a question of transportation at that point.
And whether or not they prefer other lefties to the poor right. Ned. Don't take it too hard. You got to have hope, Ned. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Discover Magazine. It's titled, "There is a rare disorder where people see other faces as dragons."
Okay. Maybe I shouldn't sound so excited, but that sounds kind of cool.
I could see it being cool. Also, potentially annoying.
Horrifying.
Right.
Yeah, horrifying, depending on your outlook. In 2011, a 52-year-old woman arrived at a psychiatric clinic in The Hague, Netherlands, with a rare and peculiar disorder. Within minutes of setting eyes on someone, their face would mysteriously morph into that of a dragon. While the woman was able to recognize faces, according to the study, in just minutes, they turned black, grew long pointy ears and a protruding snout, and displayed a reptiloid skin and huge eyes in bright yellow, green, blue, or red.
Oh yeah, that's worse. I was thinking like they looked like Falcor, and that'd be okay.
Yeah.
No, scary dragons, yeah, no,
like
yeah.
These are like full on scaly like dragon men people. This wasn't an occasional occurrence either. It would happen multiple times a day. And it wasn't just faces that triggered her symptoms. The paper explained, she saw similar dragon-like faces drifting towards her many times a day from the walls, electrical sockets, or the computer screen in both the presence and absence of face-like patterns, and at night she saw many dragon-like faces in the dark. These distressing distortions were a lifelong affliction, one the patient recalled experiencing in childhood. She remained unfazed by the dragons initially. Only in adolescence did it dawn on her that those around her did not see people as dragons as she did. I guess there comes a day when it's like, wow, your face is turning into a dragon really fast. And people are like, what?
Yeah.
She was able to graduate from high school, secure a role as a school administrator, marry, and have a child. Still, the condition did lead to experiences of isolation and depression, as well as alcohol abuse and communication issues that made it hard to hold down a job. It was in desperation that she contacted the neurologist Oliver Sacks and came to seek help at the psychiatric clinic. The team performed a routine gamut of tests, a neurological examination, blood tests, and EEG, all of which came back normal. Then the MRI scan returned and showed only a few white matter abnormalities. The abnormalities, or lesions, were located near the lentiform nucleus, which is associated with cognition and linked to cognitive impairments in schizophrenia, and the semi-oval center, which has been linked to sensory abnormalities. The dragons are just one manifestation of an incredibly rare condition called prosopometamorphopsia, or demon face syndrome, first described in 1947.
One of which is significantly easier to pronounce than the other.
Yes. Unlike the woman described in the paper, the majority of patients suffer only temporarily. In most instances, it is linked to disorders such as epilepsy or physical changes to the brain. Indeed, it was only after the Second World War and its manifestation in soldiers who had experienced head wounds that it received greater recognition in the scientific community. Further examples of, prosopometamorphopsia include individuals who see faces transform into fish heads, faces melting, and faces featuring a third or fourth eye. It has even been put forward that the art of Pablo Picasso and Francis Bacon suggests they could have experienced the condition at some point in their lives. The trip to the clinic was life-changing for the woman described in the case study, who was taken off her medication, provided with psychoeducation, and prescribed 300 milligrams of valproic acid a day. The treatment, according to the study, kept visual symptoms sufficiently under control for her to function normally. So, mostly sounds like a happy ending.
Bet she kind of wishes she's talked to a doctor sooner.
Yeah.
If you go into your 30s or 40s before you're like, maybe I should mention this to someone.
Yeah, what doctor? And how do you know they're actually not going to just put you in some kind of institution immediately?
Fair enough. Yeah, for sure.
How do you know she just can't see some lizard people that we can't?
She doesn't need the special sunglasses.
She doesn't need the they sunglasses. Exactly.
She just needs to meet some sort of like crime fighting organization to lend her talents. I've seen the shows. I know how this goes.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from Vice. Man who saved kid from Hershey Park monorail describes entering full dad mode. Have you guys seen this video?
No.
No. What?
Oh, it's great. Okay. On what should have been a regular day at Hershey Park, a child somehow breached a chained monorail track and started walking along it.
Oh.
And the whole thing could have ended in disaster if not for John Sansoni, a veterinarian, father of three, and the little boy's savior. Samson heard panic screams of, "There's a kid up there!" The exact kind of direct and snappy exposition dialogue people need to shout in such emergencies. Sure enough, there was a kid up there, alone, barefoot for some reason, and high above the park's ground. The monorail wasn't running, thankfully.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's a video. You can see it. The kid's just up there walking. There's no rails. Like, he could easily fall over left and right. So Samson went into one of those dad mode fugue states that you see in the viral videos where the baby's about to fall. Now, in some chauvinism here, I have seen mom videos do the same. They just show more of the dad ones.
Moms are supposed to do this, but when dads do it, they're so rarely around. It's a real special event.
That's probably it.
And half the time, the dangerous situation was directly created by the
dad. By the father.
Like, it's like, oh, attention. You caught him coming off this ATV. Who put him on the ATV? Who did that? Exactly.
So he did this all despite his fear of heights. It didn't bother me up there because I was just concentrating on one thing. When he reached the boy, he simply opened his arms. The kid climbed in without hesitation. I was mumbling, "I got you. You're okay," Samson recalled. Luckily, another parkour was there to help. A couple of other people jumped on the roof to help the kid down. Park staff confirmed the boy was unharmed and reunited with his family, who then left him again. No, I'm just kidding. That part was my explanation. Hershey Park issued a thank you statement that they also use as a press release, assuring customers that safety is their number one concern and blah, blah, blah. The video is out there. It's pretty viral. You can see the kid walking. I just have to say there's not a mention of the crappy parents in here at all.
Listen, I got pity for them because you never, like, it could be crappy parents for sure.
Okay,
but
fair.
I had a child at ages 2 and 3 who very much tried to escape the house in the middle of the night. And so unless you're starting to put, like, locks on the door at 6 feet high and hope he doesn't know how to drag a chair over, like, kids get away.
Yeah,
it can happen. Now, how he got over the barrier onto the monorail, that's a different issue.
And walked that far without his parents realizing that he was missing for that long.
Right.
Like, it's in the, it's but I'm not a parent, so it's easier for me to make that judgment call.
And now I'm reliving all the times that my son tried desperately to disappear. Because he was actively trying. Like, there are little kids. Again, we're going to be chauvinistic. It's the little boys.
Oh, yeah.
And they just, there's a really deep-seated need. They're like little adventurers. And as long as the train wasn't running, I'm glad there was a happy ending.
There was a very happy ending. And it went viral. It was even on CBS This Morning and stuff.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Blue Eyes Are Just an Illusion, The Dirty Truth Behind the E-Waste Recycling Industry, and Why Do Wind Turbines Have 3 Blades? So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.